King of the Worshipers! Where's all of my praises? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting through our studios in New York City, but on the road again. Left late last night to complete the work I'm doing on this very important social and environmental issue. You'll see the outcome in the near future. Today, no guest, because I wanted to have you have an opportunity to share your points of view on some of the issues that we're surrounded with, but don't seem, for whatever reason, and you may apply the reason, to address these. For example, we have a phenomenally educated and intelligent and sensitive group of people in this country who are putting almost all their energy into themselves, their careers, their families. Little energy and effort is left for our major problems. Why? I think that we should address this issue. Also, people are not taking care of themselves. I'm talking about people. I see billionaires. I see unemployed school teachers, people from all walks of life, and yet their own personal health is not a priority, nor for that matter their own family members. And they refuse to make fundamental changes, even when they've been told they're there because their own doctor said they must change their diet. They don't change. Why? What are your thoughts on that? We have a group of people who are so off the chart when it comes to being misinformed, poorly educated, and floundering to help their patients recover and reverse their conditions, the mental health field, psychiatry. So they drug everyone. These drugs have deadly side effects and effects, suicidal ideation and suicide, homicidal tendencies. Why have we allowed normal, healthy behavior, including grieving, sadness, a sense of a joy, exuberance? Why have we made these now normal behaviors into pathologies? We've pathologized life. We've pathologized children. We've pathologized women. And we're not seeing complaints or pushback. Instead, we obediently line up and accept that if we're too happy, that's a problem. If we're too interested in health, believe it or not, in the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry, being too interested in your health, whatever that means, is a mental issue, some brain chemical imbalance, all of which is completely false, but they decide by vote, no science whatsoever, because there is no science. There's no biological marker, no hormone marker that can determine that you have a mental condition. So Peter Bregan today, a board-certified psychiatrist, will talk about psychiatric drugs are more dangerous than you've ever imagined, and will play part of that. Also, I believe that identity politics is destroying much of the quality of life of people. It's certainly limiting what we can do in careers. On the one hand, just last week, three separate articles in major New York City newspapers, and that's just New York, showed that students were allowed in schools, even though they didn't take the test to show that they were to be given a chance in these schools. The whole system was gamed because some of the students weren't bright enough to get in. Had nothing to do with race, because many of these were racial schools. Teachers are told you can't fail a student. You don't want them to feel bad. You have to give them a passing grade. Don't give them a low passing grade. Give them a B, maybe a B plus or an A minus. But they failed the tests. They didn't do their homework. doesn't matter. We don't want an angry parent coming here. We don't want to be told that somehow we discriminated at some level against this person. Well, this boy came in and showed his genitalia to the teacher. Nothing happens to the boy. The teacher reports it, and the teacher's harassed. What the hell has happened to society? This isn't just about a school, a teacher. It's about society. We've lost our collective minds. We think we're something that we don't actualize. Well, let me tell you something, friends. You are only what you actualize. Everything else is purely illusion. So we're going to play a two-part series. Tomorrow is a TED Talk from a woman. I think you'll find it interesting. Today is about grievance feminism and the corruption of human rights. Janet Albertson is the person. Whether you agree or disagree in part or whole, she makes enough interesting points that we should dialogue on it. You'll have a chance to call in and dialogue. So these are some of the issues that we're going to address today. Oh, and also on the plane late last night, someone came over after the plane had stopped and said, I'd like to ask you a couple questions. And the person asked me some questions, and I'm going to address them today. I think you might find it interesting. They were not health questions. They were questions about society and our body politic. I'll share that with you. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. This comes from the University of Connecticut, and it's about menopausal women. And the question is, should menopausal women eat more black currants to prevent bone loss? Well, name me one woman you know that eats black currants. Nobody eats black currants. We should. Now, I know some of you are because I know it's in some products. But outside of that, black currants comes once a year. You can get red currants. Black currants and red currants are both terrific for you. And historically, they were used by pressing out the water and using it as a concentrate, and they'd put it in with honey, and people would be given that, a spoon of that, in the morning to help their immune systems. So here we are today. What is the one thing that every woman will go through in life if she lives long enough, and that's hormonal changes? By the way, men also go through andropause. It's a male version of menopause. Hormonal changes are one of the leading causes of bone loss, or what we call osteoporosis. Menopausal women, in particular, are more likely to experience bone loss because they are deficient in estrogen. That's the hormone that protects women's bones. Now, the amount of estrogen drops when women reach premenopause or perimenopause, then menopause, and substantially after that. Other organs can kick in and supply some estrogen, but not at the same balance as they had earlier. And that then leads to a risk of bone loss. So researchers conducted an experiment and found that black currant, it's a little tiny berry, a little bitter, is good for maintaining bone mass, especially in estrogen-deficient model. And this was published in the Journal of Medicinal Food. So, for all women, I believe all women should be taking black currant and red currant on a regular daily basis. It will help you. There's also a study from the University of Southern California that examines the disruption of circadian rhythms and says it's not just an inconvenience when you sleep, it actually increases your risk of diseases. Now, a lot of things disrupt our sleep. Working night shift. You can, if you did night shift for a career, you can knock about 10 years off your lifespan. Sleeping with any form of electromagnetic pulsing apparatus near, it's like a cell phone under our pillow, or a digital clock beside our bed, or the television that we turned off but we did not unplug. People working in hair salons, lots of electromagnetic pulses and that environment, using a microwave oven, sitting in front of a computer. These are all able to disrupt the circadian rhythm. And what they have found is that when your circadian rhythms are interrupted, you're more susceptible to diabetes and cancers and heart disease. You see, circadian rhythms are guided by internal clocks in cells that enable organisms to adapt to night and day cycles. When you disrupt these cycles, it can lead to health problems, and does, and that can lead to a shortened lifespan. This was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, so the takeaway message is simple. Get a good night's sleep. Turn off the phones. Unplug the televisions, unplug your computers, turn them off so there's no power to them. And that way, you're protecting your brain. We have thousands of studies now in the peer-reviewed literature, in the Library of Medicine, in fact, showing that meditation helps us in many different ways deal with stress. But a new study from the University of Surrey in the United Kingdom, published in the Journal of Cognitive, Affective, and Behavioral Neuroscience, found that meditation adapts the brain to respond better to feedback. So if you meditate, you're more likely to be a good listener. Meditation before a class allows you to retain more information and process that information learned in the class better. If you're having a rough time and meditate, it allows you to deal more appropriately and realistically with that stressful event. So that's what this shows. So meditation is very important. From Turin University Medical School, consuming more pomegranate can reduce your risk of obesity-related complications. Also, a separate article I read, haven't reported on it yet, from a university in England showed that pomegranate, that would mean eating the pomegranate seeds, which are delicious, or drinking the juice of pomegranate. Don't buy the commercial stuff with the sugar, but most drinking pomegranate concentrate, all of those help heal the epithelial lining of your arteries and reduce your risk of heart disease. That's important. And this was published in Complementary Therapies and Clinical Practice. So all the complications you have when you're overweight, and there are many, this randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study found that pomegranate, this was the extract, that would be the liquid, reduced plasma inflammation, oxidative stress markers, as well as serum metabolic profiles. So if you're overweight, you're going to be more susceptible to type 2 diabetes, heart disease, elevated blood pressure, stroke, gallbladder disease, fatty liver disease, high cholesterol, sleep apnea, breathing problems, arthritis, infertility, breast cancer, colon cancer, and endometrial cancer. That's what you can look forward to when you're overweight. You've heard me say many times, I will reiterate it. It is not humanly or biologically possible to be overweight and be healthy. You may not manifest all the symptoms of classical disease, but boy, are the inflammatory markers going. So taking 1,000 milligrams, that's just 1 gram, and it takes 28.35 grams to make an ounce. So you're looking at a tiny amount of pomegranate extract per day for 30 days can make a difference. But I don't suggest that. That's way too little, even though they got positive results. That's fishing at the bottom end of the spectrum. That's like going over and finding an apple laying on the ground that's half rotted, and yet One foot above that is a perfectly good, fully eaten, edible apple. Go for the higher milligrams. Get better results. I'm suggesting 1 tablespoon of pomegranate concentrate per day. All right? And then we can see how the hypersensitive C-reactive protein goes down, how the MDA, which is a is an important marker, along with interleukin 6, and your serum lipids and glucose and insulin levels, all should be going down to the normal range, and pomegranate can do that. From Loyola University, birth control pills can block blood flow to the brain. That is dangerous. So it turns out birth control pills increase the risk of ischemic strokes, which are usually caused by a blood clot that blocks or plugs a blood vessel in the brain. That keeps blood from flowing to the brain, and that's how people die, by the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, from these strokes. This was published in MedLink Neurology. Now, there are several mechanisms proposed to explain why oral contraceptives increase stroke risk during research, including raising blood pressure and making blood hypercoagulate, meaning it clumps together. But what we now know is birth control pills do this, so you might want to find another way to have safe birth control. And the University of Sheffield in the United Kingdom went further into the Mediterranean diet, and they found that it's the best single diet to fight against heart disease. Now, recently I filmed and interviewed Dr. Dean Ornish, the dean of cardiologists, the first to do an actual clinical study. There have been a lot of others who've done their own work in their own offices, their own clinical experience, but science says you doing your own clinical work doesn't count. You need a study that can be reproducible with the same results. So he did it. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. He did it again. It was published in The Lancet, the British Medical Journal. And he was able to reverse heart disease. I know. I was there and filming it. I never showed that footage. That's one of the reasons I am doing this archive. Our archivist said, prepare for a lot of work. I said, why? She said, we have over 5,000 films. I said, really? She says, yeah, Gary, you haven't stopped filming the last 40 years. And Dean Ornish's was one of them. I remember going downtown. I remember spending several days interviewing his patients. They were not taking any drugs, but they all had severe heart disease. They were exercising on treadmills. They were learning about a vegan plant-based diet and stress management techniques. And that's all he did. Not even the supplementation. He had great results. So he proved it. Now, here is something to think about, and this will allow you to better understand or appreciate when I talk about the dangers of monotheistic teaching. Monotheistic is single-minded. If you have over 900,000 doctors, more or less, and they're told that they can only change their protocols when there is a gold standard that has been established based upon strong clinical evidence and published in peer-reviewed journals, then we will change. We find out that it takes 33 years after something has been shown not to work, even to be harmful, and something better to take its place before it changes. 33 years. That's an entire adult life's work span. So it's a myth that show us a better way, a safer way, a more efficacious way, and we'll use it. Just it's a lie, and it permeates everything in life, but especially medicine. So Ornish did it. He proved it by every measure. In fact, he and I went on PBS and debated doctors who were not up to that. And you can watch the film. I believe it's on my archive on YouTube. And that was, wow, 30-some years ago. So you would think that if the number one cause of death, which is actually iatrogenesis, but we'll skip that for a moment and say it's heart disease, the second leading cause, that if you want to save 600,000 people a year, you would take a look at someone who is saving lives His latest effort was 9 out of 9 men and women who were going to have a complete heart transplant, meaning taking their heart out, putting a donor's heart in. Not one of them had to because they were on his protocol. And I filmed all that. That is in the new film I've just finished. That all of other medicine 40 years ago would have followed suit. He jumped every hurdle. Nothing changed. Not even other cardiologists. In fact, I had hired a cardiologist, a good cardiologist, to work at the Tri-State Healing Center. He didn't follow Dean Orange's protocol. They all had their egos. They all had their way of doing stuff, even when it didn't work. So the question is this. Why is it, when shown a better, safer way, with a far greater outcome for the patient, meeting all the standards of a legitimate challenge, why won't medicine change? All of medicine doesn't change. Anyhow, this newest study from the University of Sheffield explains that there is nothing in medicine that can help a heart as well as adapting a vegan diet. Quote, researchers also looked into the effects on the body of adapting a vegan diet, and that included weight loss and becoming healthier in all of the blood parameters and better oxidative stress reactions. Yet you don't see doctors using it. And that's unfortunate. So that's one of the questions I'm going to ask you to address. From the Medical College of Georgia at Augusta University, new research shows that women specifically fare much better on a low-salt diet. It's beneficial to lowering blood pressure in females more so than men, and so that's important. So lower the salt and help yourself prevent a stroke. Also, those of you who skip meals to live longer and lose weight, well, used to be called the 3 square meals a day principle, and that was a definition of healthy eating, but no more. Research shows that skipping meals here and there turns on the longevity genes and can lead to a longer and healthier life. That's also known as modified fasting. For example, this morning, I didn't get to my location until about 2 o'clock in the morning. And today I've been so busy that I had a health drink. That was it. And I probably won't eat until around 4 o'clock. I will actually be healthier because of that. Whereas if I had breakfast, lunch, and later dinner, I'd be less healthy. Now, it's not about skipping out on nutrients you need, because the whole purpose of eating food is to get the nutrients. And there's never been a supplement created that can duplicate everything that we find naturally in the whole food. But combining what we cannot get in whole foods like coenzyme Q10, NAD, resveratrol, you'd have to drink 3 cases of wine at one time to get what you get in one supplement of resveratrol. But the amount that you get in that one tablet of resveratrol is what really makes the difference in helping your genes. So the key is to know how to combine the best in eating food with the best in taking in other supplements so you don't have to be gorging yourself. And that's why I suggest people start the day with a smoothie, because if you took one scoop of a vegetable-based protein, let's say brown rice powder, hemp powder, split pea powder, you could get more protein than in a steak, because it's all usable and it doesn't have the deleterious saturated fat and arachidonic acid and nitrates in it. So it's important to understand concentration of nutrients along with a really good diet, but not to be overstuffing yourself is what caused you to live a longer life. And that's exactly what their study found. So I'm not suggesting people go on fast unless it's supervised. but I am suggesting that you restrict your caloric intake, which means you could have a gigantic salad. The salad would be so full of sprouts and microgreens and vegetables, you couldn't eat it all. And yet that is still calorie restricted. Whereas if you had a pizza, you've consumed more calories in that one pizza than you did in three salads. So, and they did an actual double-blind randomized trial about calorie restriction. This was published in Regeneration Research, and it showed that this type of fasting, meaning reducing your caloric intake, can extend your biological clock, allows you to live longer, and that's important. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 25 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us.
Just move on up toward your destination.
Nice to have you with us. We're going to play now a part of, not the whole thing. You can go to prn.fm to listen to all of his discussion. But this is Dr. Peter Bregan, board-certified psychiatrist, talking about how dangerous psychiatric drugs really are.
Is another in my simple truths about psychiatry. And the subject today is that psychiatric drugs are much, much more dangerous than you've ever been led to believe by the doctors who are prescribing them. I genuinely believe that if most people knew how dangerous the psychiatric drugs really were, most people would never start on them. And I also believe that if most prescribers had even the faintest idea how dangerous they were, they'd stop prescribing them. Well, how is it that so many people can be ignorant about psychiatric drugs? Well, the truth is because they're all getting their information from the drug companies. I mean, when was the last time you saw a car company leap up to tell people way in advance that they'd had some deaths on the road from their bad brakes? When was the last time the car companies went mea culpa and said, yes, our accelerators are sticking and running people down? Well, I can tell you the drug companies are even worse. They go to all kinds of extremes to avoid letting you know and letting your doctor know how dangerous the drugs are. I know this because I've been a medical expert in dozens of lawsuits against drug companies. I've looked inside drug companies and seen what they're really doing. I was appointed by a court in Indiana to be the scientific expert for over 150 lawsuits against Eli Lilly, suits alleging that the drug Prozac had caused violence, suicide, mayhem, mania, and psychosis. So I know what goes inside. I know as much as anyone about how dangerous the drugs are. So let me just give you a little brief outline of material you can find in the first half of my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. Obviously, the second half is intended to help you come off psychiatric drugs, because it can be very dangerous to come off drugs, as dangerous and sometimes more than starting the drugs. Let's take a look at the stimulants that you may be taking as a college student or as a parent that you may be giving to your children. Follow-up studies on people who were started on stimulants as children show that they have shrinkage of brain tissue, measurable on brain scans. They have reduced height and weight. They're being incarcerated more often than other people. They're going to mental hospitals more often. Their suicide rate has increased. Every single one of these facts documented by follow-up studies of what happens to you if you get started on stimulants. And one particularly well-done study, the rate of cocaine abuse is greater when you become a young man or woman if you've been put on stimulants as a child. That's because the stimulant drugs, such as Ritalin and Concerta and Adderall and Dexedrine, they're so similar to cocaine in their effects. All right, let's look at another group, the sedative sleeping pills that you're taking, like Sonata and Ambien, any one of the prescription sedatives used for sleep. We now got two or more good studies showing they shorten lifespan. You can Google them. You can Google practically anything I'm telling you, but you'll get more accurate and direct data from psychiatric drug withdrawal. Now, what about the benzodiazepines, the tranquilizers like Xanax and Valium and Ativan and Klonopin? They're very addictive. You know that people taking Xanax in controlled clinical trials, after a mere 6 weeks, a large percentage can't get off. After a mere 6 weeks, they become addicts to Xanax. Great for the drug business. Great for your psychiatrist or prescriber who just wants to write prescriptions. Terrible for you. These drugs now, several studies show, like Xanax and Ativan, they're causing shrinkage of the brain too. Coming off them can be an absolute horror story. It can be harder to get off those drugs than to get off opiates. They leave people who try to come off of them with horrendous insomnia, horrendous anxiety, aches and pains in their body, such pain in their feet that they can't stand up, that it's just too much pain, weird feelings throughout their body. And then the realization as they come off that their minds aren't working as well, that they have memory loss for the past and have more trouble learning. Now, I know this is hard. You know, it's hard for me to even talk about it, but it's really time to face up to just how dangerous these drugs are. So we've looked at the stimulants and the sleeping pills and the benzos. Now the antipsychotic drugs, which are not really antipsychotic drugs, they're just lobotomizing drugs that are being given to some people for sleep, like Seroquel is being given to people for sleep, and Abilify and Latuda and Risperdal and Zyprexa, all of these drugs are very damaging to the brain. They virtually wreck a part of the brain called the basal ganglia. They cause a dreadful disorder, tardive dyskinesia. I've done a whole Simple Truth video about tardive dyskinesia. They're shortening the lifespan. We have evidence that people who are put on a lifetime dose of these antipsychotic drugs for whatever reason, whether it's to help you sleep at night or because that you're hallucinating and have a lot of problems, 20 years shortened lifespan. And we know some of the ways the lifespan's being shortened, because especially these newer antipsychotics, so-called second generation or atypical antipsychotics, they're even worse than the older ones in causing a metabolic syndrome. People get obese. They get diabetes. They get pancreatitis. They get elevated cholesterol. Blood pressure is off. And then, since the drugs also cause heart arrhythmias and in combination with other drugs do even more cardiovascular damage, that's one of the ways in which people are having shortened lifespan on these drugs. The mood stabilizers, so-called, which are just emotionally flattening drugs, most of them were originally anti-seizure drugs. The one we've studied for the longest time is lithium. If you stay on lithium for a lifetime, like your doctor tells you to, you're at grave risk of severe mental problems in the form of memory difficulties, learning new materials, conducting your affairs like you have your whole life. None of these drugs are good for your brain. All of these drugs are bad for your brain, and it shouldn't be any surprise. These drugs are producing multiple biochemical imbalances in brains that don't have any biochemical imbalance until a physician or prescriber puts you on the drug. Now, please don't just stop taking your drugs, because the ultimate tragedy is that coming off of them can be catastrophic. People can get suicidal, they can get violent. Some of the drugs, you can get seizures. Some of the drugs can drop your blood pressure if you're coming off. So, you know, get good information. I put everything I know about it in psychiatric drug withdrawal. Get good information. Get some good clinical supervision. Work with your family or friends. The shorter time you're on psychiatric drugs almost certainly means that you'll have a better quality of life.
You have Dr. P. Bregan sharing some very important insights. And I'm going to play you one more clip, then I'm going to do a commentary, then I'm going to open it up for calls. This is one that you're not going to hear anywhere. This is from a woman who speaks her mind. Agree or disagree, tell me what you think.
Trigger warning that the following content will offend old-style feminists, modern-day grievance warriors, and most certainly Julia Gillard. And if I was attending a conference of university students, I'd have to politely ask you not to applause at the end, because it triggers anxiety, and if you could just please do this kind of weird jazz hand thing instead. So it's great to be here at Big Ideas. So what on earth is wrong with feminism today? Well, it's too early for karaoke, but feminism should really be summed up by Helen Reddy's iconic song, and you know the lyrics, "I am woman, hear me roar, I am strong, I am invincible." Instead, though, the lyrics of modern feminism go something like this: "I am woman, hear me whine, I am weak, I am vulnerable." Now, the notion of triage, of prioritising problems, of addressing those most in need, has been inverted by modern-day feminism. And if today's feminists ran a hospital emergency department, they would surely be rushing to fix an otherwise healthy middle-aged woman with a common cold over a young girl facing a life-threatening injury. Now, don't get me wrong, because as Anne Mann said so eloquently many years ago, women like me inhaled the benefits of feminism as naturally as the air we breathe. But today the air is toxic. Today's modern feminism is a corruption of what feminism should be. It's become a trivial movement that infantilizes women, and it's taken one heck of a moral detour away from real issues of freedom. But if feminism is not about freedom, what's the point of it? If it's not about freedom, really it's just a lobby group for pet grievances. And yet today's feminists feast on a smorgasbord of whinges and whines, of victimhood games and misogyny claims and gender binary discussions and Western world obsessions with the pay gap and quotas and glass ceilings. Brave riders of feminism's third wave include pop stars like Taylor Swift, who said recently, "I didn't see myself as held back until I was a woman." Well, as Heather Wilhelm wrote recently in The Federalist, held back from what, Taylor? Building a net worth of $250 million? Now, it's probably too much to expect modern celebrities to become feminist icons, but when women like Gwyneth Paltrow devote their time to the wonders of vaginal steaming and teaching us how to yawn properly, you really have to ask, is that the best they can do? So what about the media? How are they doing? And Rebecca, how long have I got? Let's start with the keyboard feminists who found so much offence in Mark Latham's recent crude tweeting about a handful of women. And Latham last week gave up his column at the Australian Financial Review, and I'm not defending Latham. I mean, his gratuitous nastiness so often detracts from what can sometimes be a confronting kernel of truth. But it's uncanny how the sisterhood strikes when it suits, for political purposes and not as a matter of principle. So it's apparently fine for Fairfax's Clementine Ford to call Miranda Devine an effing C on Twitter, but it's not okay for Mark Latham to use equally crude language. Well, I say a pox on both of them. Now, some years ago, Malcolm Turnbull rang me at home and he asked whether I had caught up with what Latham had said about me, and I hadn't caught up with what Latham had said. Latham had rose in our federal parliament and called me a skanky hoe. Well, I didn't know what skanky hoe meant, so while I was on the phone to Malcolm, I quickly Googled it, which was a mistake, because, needless to say, I was inundated with more porn than is healthy when you're sitting at home surrounded by children. And I don't recall a single lefty feminist ticking off Mark Latham for calling me a smelly whore, as I discovered. And of course, that stunt came about because Latham was put up to saying those words for Hansard, dared by a lefty feminist, of course. There is an in-crowd of feminists. Like the plastics in that iconic movie The Mean Girls, the plastic feminists have their own set of rules. It's not about wearing pink on Wednesdays and tracky pants on Fridays. The feminist plastics have rigorous membership rules around believing in abortion, in quotas, in glass ceilings, and, of course, assumed sexism. The feminist collective is overflowing with unprincipled trivia too. A couple of years ago, an English feminist in a London newspaper wrote this after reading something. She said, "I washed my hands with antibacterial soap, but couldn't cleanse my mind from the rising rage and desolation." Or was she reading perhaps about female genital mutilation? Or maybe child marriages? No, of course she wasn't. The enraged feminist had just finished reading the fictional 50 Shades of Grey. Now, this poor commentator would probably have to take a vaginal steam bath if she listened to the words of Esther Perel recently giving a TED talk, who made the point that most of us, in fact, get turned on at night by the very same things that we may demonstrate against during the day, that the erotic mind is not very politically correct. And I'll leave that subject to Cosmo magazine, save to say that feminism these days doesn't even understand the notion of freedom in the bedroom. So, and how are our politicians faring on the feminist front? Well, again, I'll go into overtime here. The horror, exclaimed Green Senator Larissa Waters last year. Was she responding to Islamic State's propaganda, perhaps, which says that it's permissible to buy, sell, or give as a gift female captives and slaves, for they are merely property? It says it's permissible to have intercourse with a female slave who hasn't reached puberty. No, of course she wasn't. The Green Senator was emoting over the fact that a Liberal MP, Michaelia Cash, refuses to wear the feminist label. Feminism has been corrupted by its skewed set of priorities. You'll remember that when her leadership was in trouble, Australia's first female Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, made asinine claims of sexism and misogyny against then-opposition leader Tony Abbott. And to coin a phrase from Helen Garner's wonderfully nuanced look at sex and power, Gillard had a grid labelled misogyny and she was determined to apply it to the broadest possible field of male behaviour. So when Abbott glanced at his watch in Parliament, that too was labelled sexism. And yet that speech became such a defining moment for so many modern-day feminists. On the same afternoon that Gillard gave that speech, a young Pakistani girl, Malala Yousafzai, boarded her school bus in the northwest Pakistani district of Swat, an area where the local Taliban has regularly banned girls from attending school. A gunman boarded that bus too, and he asked for Malala by name, and he fired three shots. One hit her directly on the left side of her head, travelling through her face and lodging into her shoulder. Now imagine, just imagine for a moment, if Julia Gillard had rose on that October day in 2012 and given a speech about Malala rather than herself. Now don't get me wrong, because of course we can walk and chew gum, but we are so gummed up with Western grievances such as sexism and pay gaps that we fail to even walk in the shoes of young girls who need to escape from child marriages, or women who are the subject or the victim of so-called honour-based violence. Feminism has been corrupted by its cultural infirmity too, by a deep anti-Western self-loathing. Remember, while hostages were still being held at gunpoint by a terrorist in the Lindt Cafe here in Sydney last December, many high-profile Australian women joined to rush a feel-good hashtag campaign, WISH, Women in Solidarity for Hijabs. Now, putting aside the fact that these women immediately assumed that Australians would default to evil Islamophobia, why didn't they show more concern for the hostages inside that cafe? Or even have a more nuanced discussion around the fact that millions of women are forced to wear the veil as a medieval form of oppression? Hashtag campaigns, pay gaps, quotas, trigger warnings, men looking at watches. I mean, these don't even make the list of my top 10 issues about freedom, the lack of freedom facing women today. Feminism's focus on the trifling, petty grievances debases our public conversations. But more importantly, it undermines the intellectual scaffolding around freedom. The corruption of feminism is not a women's issue. It's best understood, I think, as symptomatic of a wider and much deeper malaise, because it emerges from a decades-long corruption of human rights. And once the notion of human rights became untethered from classical liberal ideals, feminism, of course, went the same way. It's no coincidence, for example, that the corruption of feminism has occurred at the same time as our commitment to free speech has faltered. The very notion of free speech doesn't seem to cut it anymore. Now we talk about fair speech and words that don't offend or insult people. 40 years ago, the left abandoned libertarian notions of human rights and embraced this new definition of egalitarian rights. And as our Attorney General George Brandis has pointed out, that shift began with the elevation of this so-called right to equal concern and respect. Well, equal concern and respect, what on earth does that mean? And yet here was the beginning of a recalibrated human rights movement in favour of victimhood as defined by the paternalistic left. Feelings have now become the measurement of human rights. And this new victimhood movement has ditched enlightenment ideals, as Brendan alluded to, around the very notion of what it means to be a human being. No longer are people seen as autonomous and resilient, as rational human beings. Under this new framework, people are seen as weak, as vulnerable, as quivering masses of nerves in need of protection, so much so that we need trigger warnings and jazz hands and laws against words that offend and insult us. The marketplace of ideas, that place where we critique and analyse and strengthen the very best of ideas, is being usurped by a marketplace of outrage, where human rights legislation and anti-discrimination bureaucracies buttress this new victimhood movement. So two viruses, victimhood politics and this persistent strain of anti-Westernism, have corroded our most basic freedoms. And these viruses have weakened our very ability to defend our most basic values. Fundamental human rights, such as the right to freedom of expression, are now being offered to minorities at discounted prices. Hence, free speech is now fair speech. And our cultural appeasement carries costs, because it means that in Australia we have a conservative government, for example, that claims to have free speech in its DNA and yet refuses to reform the Racial Discrimination Act. Cultural appeasement has horrendous physical costs too, because it means 4,000 cases of female genital mutilation in Britain alone last year, and they're just the reported ones. So there should be no reduction, no discount, no half-price sale for our most fundamental human rights. And that means no silence around the importance of these values. A few months ago, the Swedish Foreign Minister, Margot Wallström, delivered what was a scathing assessment of the treatment of women in Saudi Arabia. And remember, there, women can't drive, they can't marry, and they can't have certain medical procedures without permission from men. So what happened? Well, what I call the oppression opera returned to town, that familiar chorus of bleating about Islamophobia that we've seen so often ever since Salman Rushdie wrote a book called Satanic Verses. The Arab world condemned the Swedish foreign minister for Islamophobia, and Saudi Arabia withdrew its ambassador to Sweden. I guess at least there wasn't a fatwa this time. But what happened outside the Arab world was even more disappointing and yet so predictable, because Wallström's defence of women's freedom was greeted with silence in the West. As Nick Cohen wrote in The Spectator, outside Sweden, the Western media barely covered this story. The scandal is that there isn't a scandal. The scandal is the strategic silence of modern feminism around freedom for women. How much easier it is to attack a pay gap, or a so-called pay gap, than female genital mutilation or so-called honour killings, which logically might just require you to make judgments about cultures that oppress women. Feminism's warriors, both male and female, have become the natural allies, or useful idiots, if you like, of those opposed to Western freedoms. The real feminists, those fighting for women's freedom, don't sit at the centre of feminism today. So how the hell do we get feminism back on the freedom track? Well, the future of feminism is inextricably linked with the future of human rights. And
what you were hearing, and there's more to it, but that's as much time as we can devote to it, is a former member of the government and the person who speaks up for what she considers a different type of look at feminism. And that's Janet, and I'll spell her last name, A-L-B-R-E-C-H-T-S-E-N. Adding to that is Saudi Arabia and its court and its prince, who's actually the for all intents and purposes, the king. His father is still king as long as he's alive, but he runs the country. He's 32 years old. Every one of the women who lobbied and demonstrated to allow women to drive for the first time and also without a man in the car, all of them have been imprisoned, tortured, and not a word about this. The entire American media and all of Congress welcomed the Saudi royal prince with open arms. Not a word was mentioned about the genocide in Yemen, not a word, or his other efforts at creating over 1,000 madrasas, which are teaching the most radical form of Islam, Wahhabism, which is distinctly different than many other forms, including Shiism. And this is just part of the hypocrisy. So now if you say a single word in support of Palestinians in the West Bank or Gaza, it's considered anti-Semitism. And now our own Congress, with Chuck Schumer and others, Nancy Pelosi, are making it a law. You cannot criticize Israel for anything. Even to suggest a boycott, which is existing around the world, could put you in prison. Now think of that for a moment. You have a freedom of speech guaranteed, but Israel's right not to be criticized for crimes against humanity usurps it. If you make one comment about Saudi Arabia and the fact that they beheaded more people this year than they did last year, I think there are over 54 people beheaded publicly. How many privately, we don't know. How many were hung, shot, we don't know. How many women were stoned to death, we don't know. Not a word of criticism. If you do dare say anything, it's now Islamophobia. You see the danger of when you step into that room where identity politics is the only reality? And that's what we're living with right now. In fact, one of the most recent victims of this was a writer for Saturday Night Live, a gentleman from India. He's Indian American. His name is Patel, Nimish Patel. He was just telling jokes, and one of the jokes they didn't like, so they cut his microphone, and he was told, leave. So think of who would not be able to say anything today. You're looking at Richard Pryor, Dick Shawn, Don Rickles, Eddie Murphy. Yeah. None of these, Mort Saul, none of these people. Shelley Berman, Stokely Carmichael. Nope. Wouldn't be allowed, because of identity politics, and someone might be offended by something someone else would laugh at. That's where we're at, and that's unfortunate. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and as soon as your call comes in, I'll be happy to put it up. Anyhow, the person obviously was a listener to Rush Limbaugh, because he mentioned, you know, that they had heard that I was concerned about the environment, but nothing wrong with the environment, you know, and I'm just a propagandist for those who want to have the government have more control over our lives. And I said, have you ever listened to my program? So I am the last person who believes our government should have any power over us, and I'm challenging constantly because they do. So this is for Mel. Mel, if you're listening, let's begin with just a few, the tipping points. Now, these are all scientifically validated, and if you go up to the National Academy of Sciences, which is not political, you'll see the melting of the Arctic ice cap. The tipping point is already passed. There's nothing we can do to stop it. The Greenland has become ice-free in certain areas, and it has got the largest fires in that part of the world. It never had fires before. And it's melting, and melting faster than anyone anticipated or even any mathematical model participated. The disintegration of the West Antarctic ice sheet already happening, that itself would raise sea level by 16 feet. The loss of our glaciers, the loss of what is called albedo, A-L-B-E-D-O, that caused the rise, because albedo allows when the sun comes down and hits clean snow, it bounces harmlessly back into the atmosphere. But when it's melted and it goes into the water and the water is dark, then it raises the temperature of the water, hence loss of albedo. Fresh water from the Arctic and Greenland is collapsing the Gulf Stream. As the Gulf Stream collapses, as it did 12,000 years ago, you could throw northern Europe into a new cold spell where the climate would not allow people to be able to grow most things. El Nino has become a permanent climate fixture. The disruption of Indian West African monsoons, the melting permafrost and tundra releasing vast quantities of methane over millions of miles, what are called clathrate, C-L-A-T-H-R-A-T-E, gun effect, the desertification of the world, the Arctic ozone hole, the loss of rainforest, especially at Amazon and New Guinea, the loss of boreal forest, that's in the entire northern hemisphere, Russia, Canada, Norway, Sweden. These are tipping points. I'm just going to today mention the tipping points. Tomorrow I'm going to mention the positive feedback loops that are exacerbating climate change, all due to our actions. In fact, everything we do, to one degree or another, will contribute to a lessening of climate change or the acceleration of climate change. And that is a problem. And for everyone, thank you for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Be ground.